Welcome to the Pardes Parsha podcast. My name is Zvi Hirschfield, and I have the distinct privilege and pleasure of discussing the profound analysis and deep insights into the Parsha from my wonderful colleagues at the Pardes Institute. So glad you could join us. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another podcast for the Pardes Parsha podcast. We are on Parshat Kedoshim. We are making our way through the book of Vayikra, the book of Leviticus. We are taping this in the shadow of, overwhelming events of Saturday night with Iran attacking, and thank God, Israel, with the help of its allies, defending itself. But still, for me, and I'm sure for who I'll introduce him on, Brent Spodek, Rabbi Brent Spodek, who's joining us, it's almost a surreal moment. We're going to be here talking about the Parsha when many of us are just feeling the sense of what's going to happen next, where are things headed. So that's in the air. I wanted to make you guys aware of that as you are listening. And let me welcome a return guest. I believe this might be his third or fourth time. If we gave away swag, you would definitely be entitled to something good. Rabbi Brent Spodek, who in addition to being a beloved communal rabbi and a relationship counselor, is also a Pardes faculty member for Pardes North America. Welcome, Brent.
Thank you, Tzvi. I'm delighted to be back here and delighted to be learning with you again.
Well, we're excited to have you. And at least personally, I definitely need to get my mind into some Torah and not all the other stuff that's swimming around there. So I'm really excited to have you. So here we are on Parshat Kedoshim. And it's a challenging Parsha. The Parsha begins with this almost overwhelming command, be holy. And I guess there are two ways you could go. You could see that as almost an isolated commandment, be holy, as Rashi sort of does, and then we get other commandments to follow. Or you could argue that the other commandments to follow offer us a recipe for how to achieve holiness. So I know you've thought about this issue. Where are you with this question?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I'm reminded, in addition to that distinction of, is Kedoshim, is holiness something, is that its own commandment, or is it sort of a macro umbrella category for everything else? I'm actually having the back of my mind Yeshayahu Leibovitz talking about the holiness of Israel as an aspirational and a perpetually aspirational category, right? It's Kedoshim Tihiyu. And that holiness is not something we are, there's not something inherent, but it's something that we're constantly striving to achieve. And perhaps, I think the word is asymptotically, like it's, you're striving, but you can never actually get there. The work is in trying to be holy, not being holy. That is something only God can do.
So here we are being commanded to at least aspire to be holy. What commandments or commandments stands out for you as the one that feels most relevant to you in this aspiration towards holiness that we're working on?
Well, the one that stands out most to me in this parsha, but it actually has to do with what I think the Torah is asking of us in general, is Pasuk Vav. Lo telech rechiel be'amecha. Don't go as a talebearer. Don't go gossiping, slandering among your people. Right? And it seems so fundamental. And so many of the things elsewhere in the parsha, it talks about the importance of the honesty of weights and measures. Right, which is a different sort of communication, right? I'm a merchant, I'm communicating with you about so and so many grams, recognizing that you measure in grams, so and so many grams of flour or dates, right? And I need my scale to be honest. I need some sort of honesty in how we're communicating. I think here, this question of rechilas, of gossip, rumor mongering, slander, right, also has to do with how do we create relations between each other in which there's the possibility of holiness. We talked months ago, I think, about how in the instructions for the Mishkan, we're told about the Kruvim need to be standing sort of almost in a posture of surrender, right? This posture of openness with their arms up. And that's great for Kruvim. But for those of us whose lives are communicated much more with our mouths than with our arms, how do we create those conditions in between two people in which the divine presence can reside? I think those are the commandments that strike me.
Well, it's interesting, especially as you note this idea of speech. A lot of us grew up, you know, as kids being told sticks and stones will break my bones, but names will never hurt me. This idea that talk is just talk. And I can understand the need to be honest in business because you can end up cheating somebody out of, you know, money out of material gain. But why do you imagine the Torah would put such an emphasis on, you know, gossip? Gossip, I think, to a lot of us feels mostly harmless. It is often one of the first topics of small talk is talking about other people. And I'm wondering, what is the link do you see between this issue of gossip and holiness?
I think at its extreme, I think it's actually entirely connected to violence, even as there's a big spread in between those. And I think it has to do with when we do and don't see other people as means and when we do and don't see them as ends in and of themselves, right? So take a, you know, the childhood example, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. At a certain level, what's going on when kids are bullying each other, kids are beating each other up, is one kid is saying, my story, my understanding of what's going on, my understanding of who you are, my understanding of who I am, is so much more important than yours that I'm going to impose it on you by force. And I'm going to call you names and I'm going to insult you. And if you don't like it, I'm just going to beat you up because I'm imposing my will on you, right? And when we gossip about people, in some ways, what we're talking about, it depends. And I want to come back to what you said about the social connectivity of gossip, particularly, as you pointed out, we're recording this before Pesach. So a lot of us, a lot of big family gatherings coming up, a lot of big, oh, did you hear what cousin so-and-so did? Here, I'll give you a little example in my own life. This was a while ago. I overheard somebody in my family talk about something I had done, right? I had run some trail running races, which is something I had gotten into in later in life. And I heard them talking about me and they're like, oh, it's amazing. Brent's been doing all this running. He's lost a ton of weight. And it sort of pierced me. On the one hand, like they weren't exactly saying anything malicious, but it was very much not the story I had told. The story I told is, wow, I had worked incredibly hard to achieve this physical challenge that was a huge milestone for me. And the story I told was about perseverance and overcoming difficulty because I'm not a very good runner, but I worked really hard at it. As a side effect, I lost a bunch of weight. But in the way that my relative told the story, the only thing that mattered was I met their understanding of what, you know, people are supposed to look like in terms of weight.
So let me understand a little bit, because I guess I always assume the problem with gossip, number one, is sort of the truthfulness of it, that when other people report things, they report it very selectively and often, and that slander, of course, is outright lying about other people, and that can really harm one's reputation, other people's perception. But it sounds like you're talking about something else. You're talking about the idea that when people talk about me, they are in a certain way interfering with my power to tell my story about myself. And they're sort of denying me. They're taking away that power that I have. Am I getting you correctly?
Yeah, exactly. Right. When we learn in the Mishnah that whoever kills a person kills an entire world, I think there's a certain sense of somebody's completeness in themselves is both in their experience of themselves and how they understand themselves. And we always are understanding other people through our lenses, right? I don't see you, Tzvi, purely. I see you as I see you, as I know you, as my experience of you. My experience of Tzvi is mediated through my experience of myself. But it's an act of love. It's an act of generosity. It's a gift for me to say, this Tzvi, who I know and respect and admire, how does he understand himself? What's going on for him? What's the story he's telling? Can I stretch myself to understand his reality on his terms and not assume I could do it on my terms? And when we gossip, right, we're actually building bonds with a second party, bonding in putting a narrative on the third party. Oh, hey, you know that guy over there? He did such and such. Oh, yeah, he did such and such. Now we're connected at the expense of that guy, even if we're saying something good about
him. Well, let's pursue that a minute because it feels like it's so natural to share information about other people, right? That's how we know who's out there and who to talk to and who does what. Like, I'm just sort of wondering how you balance what you're talking about with sort of this very natural human, almost essential sharing of information that happens within any community or any society.
Yeah.
I mean, are you suggesting we can't ever talk about anybody at all?
No, although that is more or less what the Chafetz Chaim writes, right? In Hilchot Lashon Hara and Shmirat HaLashon, one of the dominant books in sort of speech ethics in Judaism, he does basically say you should never talk about other people. I don't think that's realistic, and I don't think it's necessary, even outside of the particulars that he lays out. You know, if you need to go tell the rabbi that somebody's sick, you need to go call a policeman. Even outside of that, I think the social connections that come from talking to people are vital. They make up our society. But so much of what Kiddushim is about is, what sort of society are we building? So one thing I wonder, even if I'm talking to, you know, person A about person B, right, is, in what ways am I coming with some curiosity? In what ways am I understanding that, you know, the bracha when you see a lot of Jews is, blessed is the Holy One, the knower of secrets. The Holy One knows all the secrets. I don't know all the secrets. So when I'm talking about this third party, in what ways am I pushing myself, challenging myself to be curious? Huh, what is going on for them? Hey, partner. Hey, my wife. Hey, my friend. Do you know what's going on with this person? I've been concerned about this person, right? What's the reality for them? And just shifting from that place of, let me tell you what's going on with this jerk, to a place of curiosity, huh, I wonder what's going on, I think is a huge and important shift.
So if I understand you correctly, it's okay to be curious about other people. An open question of, you know, what's happening with X. Although I guess it could still be seen as like inviting gossip from the person you're asking, right? Once you ask that question, what's going on with Jim? You never know if that person is now going to unload a whole lot of gossip on you. We can talk about the role of the listener in a minute. But I guess the solution would be, go talk to the person themselves, right? If you're really curious about that person, don't go to the third party. Go to that person themselves and see what you can find out there.
Yeah. I mean, to the greatest extent, when you're talking directly to someone, it's a very different experience. And this is true personally, and this is true politically as well, right? We live in a context, and the digital arena has made this vastly, vastly more powerful, though it's always been the case. When we talk to people who see things the way we do, we get to reinforce the narratives we tell without actually questioning them. And without interrogating a little bit, wait a minute, am I seeing this the right way? Right? Because we'll go quickly to the stories we tell. And the stories we tell may or may not be accurate. There's a historian at Hebrew University, I mean, he's quite prominent, Noah Yuval Harari, talks about, it's not the ability to communicate that is unique to Homo sapiens. It's the ability to communicate fictions, right? All sorts of animals can say, oh, look, it's dangerous. There's a lion over there, right? Animals have a way of communicating that. But only humans can say, oh, that lion, right? And the example he gives, that lion over there is the guardian of our tribe. We can communicate stories, and our stories are so valuable. I mean, Judaism is our stories, right? Our stories are incredibly valuable, but they may or may not always be accurate. And keeping that in mind is so important.
Meaning that because we have the ability to invent and create, in a way, it makes us unreliable on a certain level when we're sharing information, right? Because the animal who can't invent and create, the story you get is the story that's there. There's a lion over there.
Yep.
But your point is that as human beings, our gift of creating or making things fit into a larger story or adding details that aren't there, that gift, in a way, makes us highly unreliable reporters.
Yeah. And our reporting, including our reporting to ourselves, is always and necessarily informed by our prior experiences, our understanding, our neuroses, our hangups, our hopes, all of those things, right? You pointed out, I'm a congregational rabbi. Any congregational rabbi has had this experience, right? You put in a lot of energy, you put together a program, you advertise it, you put in the newsletter, right? It's going to be a great program. You've given a lot of thought, whatever. And then the program comes, the evening comes, and nobody comes. You're expecting 100 people, you have 7 people in the room. Ouch, right? Now, I, as the rabbi, I can tell all sorts of stories. I might start telling stories about the people. They don't really care. They're not dedicated enough. They're slackers. I might start telling stories about me. I'm so out of touch. The programming I put on is so, it's narishkeit, it's nonsense. Nobody wants what I offer. I might start telling stories. Oh, you know, there was a big storm. People didn't want to go out. The weather was bad. And any one of those things may or may not be true. But when I start going around as a talebearer, right? I think in part of the importance of the pasuk from Vayikra is lo telech rachil. Right? It's the going out and doing it. You're going to tell the story, but it's the going out I start reinforcing that story, whatever story it is I'm telling, either about the people or myself or the program. The more I tell the story, the more it gets reinforced in my mind. And the more I think the story I'm telling is not an interpretation, it's actually just the facts. But the facts are always my interpretation of them.
So the problem with gossip is it doesn't acknowledge our subjectivity in our reporting, right? It basically comes back to the first thing you said. It assumes the power of determining the objective truth about someone or about a situation when in fact, I don't have that. So in a way, what you're saying is the biggest problem with gossip is the lack of humility, right? This idea that I deserve to be in control of the information, of that person's story, of what happened. And maybe that, does that get us back to the secret of holiness?
In some ways, yeah. I mean, I think that posture of humility is right on. And I so appreciate the way you put it, I deserve to be in control. There's a line, it's at the beginning of Brachot, that there are 1,000, and I may or may not have the exact citation right, there are 1,000 demons on the left and 10,000 on the right, and if we had eyes to see them, we would not be able to stand for the fear, right? And the sense of, we don't know what's going to happen next, right? As you pointed out, Israel just endured this missile attack, terrible, and the missiles were almost entirely blocked by defensive measures, amazing. We don't know what's going to happen next. And that makes us tremendously anxious, makes me tremendously anxious, makes all of us tremendously anxious. And so we tell the stories to reassure us that we have some control. We know what's going on. We know what's going to happen next, right? Because sitting with the uncertainty is really, really difficult. And that's why I think the blessing of the Kaddish Baruch Hu as the knower of secrets is so important. Because in some ways we're saying, you are the knower of secrets. I am not the knower of secrets. You know what's going to happen next, maybe. I definitely don't know what's going to happen next, and I need to somehow be present to that. And gossiping is a way of reducing that anxiety, but not in a healthy way.
So let's turn for a moment to the role of the listener. Let's say I am really managing to not gossip about other people. Okay, I'm really being very careful. I've listened to you in this podcast now. I've read the Chafetz Chaim. I'm really working at it. What do you suggest when I'm in the moment of somebody else wants to gossip to me? How do I handle that situation without sounding like a holier-than-thou judgmental and not get the reaction of, oh, look who thinks they're so holy because they listen to Rabbi Brent Spodek. They're not going to listen to gossip. Oh. I can imagine that happening. So maybe from personal experience, what do you do if you don't want to be a listener? Because you start off by telling us it's always at least a two-person game. There's the talker and the listener. And whereas the talker initiates, as you're going to about, I'm sure, if there's no listener, there's also no gossip, right? It can't go anywhere. So what do you recommend for our innocent listener struggling to maintain humility and giving other people the power of their own story? And what do I do?
First of all, it's really hard, right? With this and with all sorts of things, it is much easier to give the sermon than really internalize the sermon. I work on this all the time. And the Chafetz Chaim, he points out, you know, it's no accident that our fingers are the exact size they need to be stuffed inside of our ears so that we can block our hearing where we need to by just literally sticking our fingers in our ear. I don't actually recommend that as a conversational gambit, but I do appreciate that sentiment. I think so often the challenge is to recognize that the person who's talking to you is trying to make a bid for connection, right? Is trying to connect with you. If I say to you, hey, Tzvi, you know that crazy thing Misha's doing over there? At some level, what I'm trying to do is connect with you, Tzvi, right? Even if it's at the expense of a third party. So one thing I think that's really important is to recognize that there's a bid for connection there and actually meet them there and just meet that emotional bid, whether or not you engage with the content of it. So if somebody comes and says, and I'm just picking on Mish because I know we both know her and love her and think she's awesome. But if I come to you and say, oh, Tzvi, I'm so mad about what Mish did. She did X, Y, and Z, and how could she do that, right? I can imagine a wise-hearted response being like, oh my God, that sounds really frustrating. You must be really pissed off. Mish is usually such a considerate person. I wonder why she did that, right? So by just joining with them, right? Wow, that must be really frustrating. Wow, I can see why you're really pissed off, right? I'm validating the feelings and I'm validating that sense of wanting to connect with me. But I'm bringing exactly what you said, a little humility, a little curiosity to be like, huh, what is going on with that person over there? Right? Does that make sense?
It does, but I'm still wondering, have you ever found yourself in a situation where somebody wanted to share gossip with you and you had to look them in the eye and say, you know what? I'm not comfortable hearing what you want to share with me.
All the time. But just not quite in those words, but yeah, all the time.
This mitzvah in particular, it shows you the difficulty that you can't be holy on your own. The commandment is in the plural. We're all going to have to be holy together. The individual, it literally cannot be holy on its own when it comes to gossip, because even as a passive listener, they're still encouraging and empowering gossip. And there is something about this interaction that it's going to force us in some way to hold each other, sometimes to uncomfortable standards. That my obligation is not only to try to maintain my own holiness, but to also look out for yours as well. Which is why, of course, it's no accident that the mitzvah of rebuke, right, is located in this same section. That we can't just be passive in the face of negative behavior, but we, in fact, sometimes have to stand up to it.
I think, yes, sometimes we need to stand up to it. But I think there's also, it's not just a resisting energy, right? When somebody comes with gossip, resisting it. I think what there's also the possibility for a deeper sort of connection there. Because when we are gossiping about someone, we're talking about somebody, there's a need underneath there for connection. Even at its richest, gossip isn't, at least I don't find, the strongest connection with someone, right? There's always a slight residue of grossness to it, right? But if I can really connect with someone's feeling, right? So you go back to that example before, if I come be like, God, that me, she did such and such and such and such, right? What I'm saying, my words are about me, but the music, right, of what I'm saying, the feeling of what I'm saying is I'm hurt, I'm angry, I'm disappointed, I'm betrayed, right? And if I join with somebody on that surface level, on the verbal level of that third person, I'm actually missing the opportunity to engage with them on a more interior level. And, you know, it says Mishnah, Eretz me Eretz titzmach, Emet me Eretz titzmach, right? Truth sprouts from the ground. And I think that sense of like the real stuff comes up from the inside. And we miss an opportunity when we only stay at that surface level, because we can go much deeper and connect much more strongly.
If we can resist the impulse to want to hear all the juicy details about someone, because, you know, we are endlessly curious about one another, and especially the schmutz, unfortunately, is endlessly inviting. It takes a lot of discipline to learn to not engage it on that level, I would think.
Absolutely. And although I put it in the affirmative to rest in the curiosity. You know, before I was a rabbi, before I was even a rabbinical student, I was a newspaper reporter. And my favorite thing to write were feature stories. You know, I did the daily reporting, cops and fires and city council and all that, but I loved writing the long form features. And one of my editors, when I was a reporter in North Carolina, said, every single person has a story to tell. The best reporters can get it out of anyone. But that sense of everyone's got a story. And there they were talking as a reporter, but Rabbi Nachman says much the same thing when he says, every single person has a nekudat tovah, and the job of a religious person is to draw it out. There's a difference between journalism and Hasidus, but there's a similarity about the humility. I don't know everything about this other person. If I'm telling the story, they're just crazy. I definitely don't know everything about them. And cultivating a sense of curiosity. What's going on underneath the hood there? Who are you? Where's your nekudah tovah? What's your story?
As opposed to talking about the third party.
Yeah.
So I want to come to a broader issue of negative speech that I think is very much alive now in the Jewish community, particularly in the diaspora. Is it okay during this time, if we have negative feelings or negative interpretations of Israel, what does it mean to share that with other people? I know it's not quite gossip, but the sense of what does a person do who at the same time has a lot of critique of what Israel has been doing for a variety of reasons, but at the same time has a lot of worry and concern about how Israel is being perceived in the world. What would you advise people who are sort of caught in that situation right now?
I appreciate you put that how I might advise it for other people, as if it's a category that doesn't include me. So I think there's a lot there, and it is a painful and it is a scary situation. And, you know, just on the surface of it, but I think this actually gets also to the heart of it, for some people, Israel and Palestine, for that matter, are these abstractions, these things that exist in the words, in the newspaper, in space. And for other folks, Israel is very, very not abstract. It's where our friends, our family live. It's where, all right, I say this as a Zionist diaspora Jew, it's a place I am in regularly, and I am very regularly in touch and in conversation with many different people there. So there is both the abstract question of the state of Israel, right? And then there are the particular people who I know and love and am in relationship with. And so I think in thinking about this, one thing to do is notice the tendency to tell stories about anyone. And, you know, recent experiences here, as some of the fights about Israel and Palestine have played out in the diaspora, I've been on more sides of this than I wish to be, and found that rather than engage with really complicated feelings, it was a lot easier for a lot of people to just tell stories about these other folks. They're just self-hating Jews. They're just Zionist baby killers. They're just terrorists, right? And I think one thing to look out for is actually that word just. It's as if you're trying to justify something. And recognizing that simple story, if you can describe 7 million people in a sentence, you're probably oversimplifying. You're probably missing something. And cultivating some of that humility might be worthwhile, right? Why might somebody be doing that? Why might a state be doing that? You know, when it comes to political actors, right, somebody like a prime minister, right, it's not unreasonable to talk about them, particularly in their public role, right? They're a public figure operating on behalf of the public. But I think in all cases, the more we end our sentences with exclamation points, the less we're interested in somebody's response. The more we end our sentences with a question mark, the more we're trying to build a connection and build a society that has capacity for holiness. So as much as anything, I'd say that when you find yourself speaking, are you speaking with exclamation points or are you speaking with question marks?
And it sounds like you're also, again, reminding us that negative speech in whatever form is often coming to handle an anxiety or a fear that is within us. And the desire to simplify, to accuse, help solve some of that, even though in the long run, it's probably not going to get us anywhere. But I still want to push you on one point, and this is the question of this sense of, are you comfortable being critical of Israel, publicly at least, during this time, or do you feel like something else has to be expressed in your role as a rabbi and a community leader?
Critical of Israel is a very broad phrase. I think it's entirely legitimate as a Jew or just a person in the world to look at the actions of a state and offer some interpretation of it. I think the danger is the certainty that your interpretation is a right one and a correct one. So to be critical of the actions of a government is, to my mind, not rechilus. It's not gossiping, right? But it's also not necessarily productive. There was an article in the Times this past week by Roxane Gay, a columnist, and I really appreciated what she said. She was writing about the phenomenon of open letters. There are open letters everywhere about Israel-Palestine. And she wrote, we know what the writers of these letters think and feel. We know what they want, but we don't really know if anyone is listening. We don't know how to translate those words into meaningful action. We don't know what could happen if, instead of talking at one another by the way of open letters, we found better ways to talk with and listen, truly listen to one another, to participate in both the call and response. And something that's been very distressing to me in recent conversations or lack of conversations about Israel-Palestine here in the U.S. is the inability of many, many actors to come with any curiosity about why the other side might be thinking or feeling the way they are, but instead be so confident that they themselves are the knower of secrets that the other people, they must just be crazy.
Okay. I have to say your optimism is really beautiful, that you really believe that we can overcome these desires and find a deeper way to listen and talk to one another. I wish I was there. But I think maybe that's the point. Aspirationally, that's where we would at least aspire to be. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, two things. Yes, absolutely. It's an aspirational thing. And I think it should be an aspiration for everyone at every sector of society to seek to expand our hearts to listen. And I'm a congregational rabbi. I'm a teacher of Torah. I absolutely recognize there are people in the IDF, in the high command, there are people in different roles who have to play different roles, and that's not illegitimate. I think it's important for me and for all of us as, you know, as rabbis, as teachers of Torah, right, to recognize, okay, there are people who have to play those roles, and that's real and legitimate, but we don't all have to play those roles, right? And there's in some ways a burden and a responsibility of playing those roles that those of us who don't have to carry that burden shouldn't be limited by, because we can afford to stretch and say, what's going on for those other people? Those enemies, how are they understanding this? There are people who don't have the luxury of doing that because they've got to man the tanks and guns and bombs. But that's not me. I have that luxury of trying to stretch my heart and listen in ways that are hard.
With the hope you think that your feelings of anger or fear or disappointment will lessen as you develop more empathy for what the other side is thinking or doing.
I think of it this way. If the basement of what I want this world to be is a place where I and you and our loved ones are physically safe, sometimes we need force for that. Sometimes we need guns and bombs for that. I don't like that, but it's true, right? But that's the basement, right? I don't aspire to a world in which my safety is guaranteed by guns and tanks. I recognize that might be. What I aspire to, what I reach for, is a society of compassion where I can try to understand others and they can understand me. That's the aspiration.
And I guess as a student and teacher of Torah, if the Torah commands it, on some level, it's got to be doable. And maybe that's a very important thing to think about right now, especially in this time where I know I myself am so much in the fight or flight, so much in this sense of despair and fear, that holiness is still possible. I think to hold on to that idea as I'm living in the basement, deep, deep down in that basement, but that to say that holiness is possible, and here the Torah is telling us it's possible, it's a really important reminder, as hard as it is for me to hear. Because sometimes when you feel so far away from it, an aspiration almost hurts because you feel like it's so far away from you. But I guess without that aspiration, there's no hope of coming out of the basement. I'm going to keep using your metaphor until I've wrung it dry. And so I think that that's an important message that I feel like you're always putting out there, which is this sense of you've got to hold on to these aspirations and work towards them, especially when they feel so far away. And the answer is not to go to the other extreme, but rather to leave that openness, leave that opening for that aspiration to happen, not in a blind denial sort of way, but in this sense of I'm going to hold on to that hope and still work towards it, even in times when it's extremely difficult.
Absolutely. And I want to be super clear. None of what I'm saying is in any way a judgment on anyone. Where I hear it the most for me, and many years ago, in a very hard period of my life, my wife was very seriously ill, and I was really in deep despair. I was in the basement. Rabbi Rachel Cowan of Blessed Memory pushed me to articulate gratitude every day. And I mean, I said to her, you know, and Rachel was somebody I admired tremendously. I said more or less like, are you out of your mind? It hurt. The idea that she was telling me I should be grateful felt like an affront. I was like, what are you talking about? I should be grateful. My wife's in the ICU. And what she said is, I know where your wife is and I know how much that hurts. The darkness will eat you alive if you let it. Your gratitude is resistance against the darkness. And that really pierced me. And it allowed me to see articulating a narrative other than the one that was so alive for me, which was the woe is me narrative. And indeed, woe is me. It was a terrible situation. But coming to see gratitude as a little bit of resistance against that despair, I think in these moments of political despair that I know you're feeling, that I'm feeling 10,000 miles away, with not the acuteness that I know you're feeling in Israel, right? Having that exactly as you put it, not as what's expected right now, but as the aspiration of what could be possible, so we don't get eaten alive by our despair.
As your dear friend Rabbi Nachman said, when you're stuck in the darkness, as we all typically are, you have to choose to see the light before the light will appear.
Amen.
Struggling with that every day, but I'm grateful for your reminder. So we're going to end it here. As usual, thank you, Brent, very, very much. In your own quiet, gentle way, you've challenged me and all of us, I think, a lot, in a very kind way, but a lot of challenge nonetheless. But I think most of us who listen to you really get the feeling that you live the Torah you teach. And so I think you're a positive example of what living with these aspirations towards holiness can offer. So speaking on behalf of both of us, our prayers and our hopes are by the time that all of you are at Parshat Kedoshim and listening to this, the hostages will be home safe and healthy. There will be peace and things will be looking a lot better. Our hopes and prayers. And until that time, thank you, Brent, and all of you have a Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Tzvi. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And indeed, Shabbat Shalom, and may it be better times for all of us soon.
Amen. Thank you for tuning in to the Pardes Parsha podcast, recorded here at Nomi Studios in Jerusalem. We hope you enjoyed this week's episode and gained some new insights and perspectives on the Torah portion. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite streaming platform and leave us a 5-star review if you enjoyed the episode. Your feedback helps us reach more people with these important conversations. Thanks again for listening, and we look forward to exploring the Torah with you again next week on the Pardes Parsha podcast. Shabbat Shalom.